Hello, good evening, and welcome to Seascapes. Tonight, we'll have personal accounts from survivors of the Fastnet disaster, and we'll be celebrating 100 years of the Baltimore lifeboat. Over the summer, Seascapes marked the 40th anniversary of the 1979 Fastnet race, when a Force 10 storm sank 5 yachts and 21 lives were lost. There were 18 Irish yachts participating in the race, and Howth Yacht Club, which had 4 yachts under its burgee, recently hosted what may be the first and the last reunion of its type for the surviving Irish sailors. Lorna Siggins went along.
Several months after the 40th anniversary of the 1979 Fastnet yacht race, the RNLI Howth lifeboat took to sea with April English on board, widow of professional yachtsman Joe English, and she laid a wreath at sea for all those who had not returned. Afterwards, they were also remembered at a lunch in Howth Yacht Club, where representatives of all 18 Irish yachts which had entered the 79 event were there. I spoke to one of the organisers, Kevin Burke, who had been on board Rapparee in 79, and his navigator John Marrow, and their wives Angela and Caroline, and they paid tribute to the emergency services, and they also recalled their experiences on that fateful week.
I remember that I was down in Rosslare Harbour, I think. We went down for the weekend with the 3 boys, my mum and my sister, and we had a lovely meal on the Sunday evening, and then on Monday morning, I remember Bob Geldof playing, you know, I Hate Mondays. And we turned on, then the RT News came on and they started talking about this terrible disaster about the Fastnet. So we kind of hightailed it back to Dublin, and then, you know, lots of people were coming and trying to help with winds, tides. And they were, Shannon, we had them plagued with phone calls, and they were very positive and never told us to go away and leave us alone. We're busy. They were wonderful. And then I got a phone call on the Thursday from John himself, from Dunmore, from a phone box somewhere on the pier, that he was there ashore and he was in good health and good spirits. So I got in the car and got a speeding ticket going down.
I was a navigator on Rapparee, Brian Kelly's Rapparee, yes. Yeah. That's right. I still have the weather facts, the original weather facts from the race office. That I got about an hour before the start, yes. By sheer accident, it's been in a wardrobe for 40 years, so there was no wind at all for the first few hours, but and then it slowly started to build, and you had landmarks then, but once it really hit, when we were in the middle, we just had the mast up and were drifting with everything down, you know, it was the mast, we were still at 45 degrees, and it was... It was blowing very hard. In fact, we'd done a course on astro navigation, and we took the only navigational aid we had was a plastic sextant, and we took a sunshot, and that gave us our position 40 miles south of Dunmore East. So we decided, rather than go to Cork, we'd start heading back towards Howth. So we ended up then in Dunmore East was the first port of call.
Kevin Burke, Rapparee. Remember, we were on a 31 foot boat, which was quite small, even though it was quite a revolutionary design at the time, which is a Shamrock, designed by Ron Holland, incidentally. And that was only launched in 1979. And okay, we battened down the hatches and we put in the washboards and went down below. So you feel you're kind of entombed and you're at the mercy of the giant seas outside. So there's a kind of a quietness, hush descends on everybody, is my memory, and you're just locked there, locked away, hoping for the best, without anybody speaking to each other, in actual fact, and they're my memories. You could say a deafening silence below, but thunderous noise outside, if that's a bit of a contradiction, that's what it was like, and... I suppose you could say there was a modicum of religion crept into the whole atmosphere. And certainly there was a silent prayer in the cockpit on that day. We were all just... we were lying in our bunks as much as we could without tumbling out of them, because we didn't have lead cloths. And lead cloths are there to keep you in your bunk, to prevent you from rolling out, but... You know, people were being tossed around in all different directions.
But at one point you got up to cook.
So I decided maybe the crew needed some replenishment, and I strapped myself into the galley, lit the gas, and I put on a pot of potatoes. So I judged the wave motion outside, and if I saw a particular big wave was coming, I'd disconnect the gas, take the pot off the gas, and wait for the wave to pass. Go through the procedure, light the gas again, put the potatoes on, and away we went. Now, it took some time, no doubt about that. I eventually got the potatoes to a satisfactory condition. It wouldn't be approved of by many chefs these days, but they seem fine to me. So I mashed all that up with a tin. I think it was corned beef. I know people say Spam, but it was corned beef, and I had this glutinous mass of food anyway. And I went around to the crew in their bunks thinking this would be their saviour, but in actual fact it just added to their nausea, and people turned from white to green with my presentation. Terrible, but I ate the whole pot myself. You'll be glad to hear. And I had a few Mars bars there just to wash it down.
In all the 40 years, he has never cooked since. I'm the long-suffering sailor's wife, and he has never cooked since. I was working in AIB at the time, and one of our clients, his name was Bud Bryce, was a captain with Aer Lingus. He was also a member of Hoth Yacht Club, and he called in to me in the bank, and he had just come in from a flight from New York, and he had checked up with Shannon Air Rescue, who had relayed the coordinates from the RAF helicopter which had flown over Rapparee. And I couldn't wait to get home to get my school geography atlas out of the attic, probably, and with a ruler trying to work out and pinpoint where on the atlas in the Irish Sea the boat was. And Bud was able to tell me that the yacht had relayed to the RAF that they were hoping to make their way to Dunmore East, and subsequently that's what they did.
We landed in Dunmore East, and I think we stayed the night in the Haven Hotel, and we were at traffic lights the next morning, and ironically a car ran into us, quite a serious rear ender, not a tip in the back, like a huge damage to both cars, and was no after effects and no hospitalisation. So having survived the previous experience, and then to be nearly written off the next day on the road was just too much to take.
The Fastnet prompted one of the largest post-war maritime rescue responses in these waters, and among those playing a key role in 1979 was Commodore John Kavanagh on the Ellie Deirdre, and he had left Cork Harbour on the Monday after the race start for a routine patrol, as he told me.
Pressure at the time, the barometric pressure was 1,014 leaving Cork Harbour, and at 10 o'clock that night it had dropped to 989, which was a 25 millibar, or as they say nowadays, hectopascals drop, which was absolutely unprecedented, which indicated something serious was on the way in. So we turned back to Fastnet, and straight away we had the first mayday call from the yacht Regardless, which was a mile from Fastnet and had lost its rudder. So we waited there until the Baltimore lifeboat came out and took her in tow. So then we spent the next 3 or 4 days actually in the race area, checking out various yachts. We escorted a number of yachts back to Cork Harbour, including Silver Apple of the Moon under Clayton Love. And it was nice to meet him today. We had to tow a number of yachts back into the harbour, which had been abandoned during the race. And the last item was a rather sad story about the trimaran, which had been just accompanying the race as observers. And it hadn't survived the race, and the crew of four had been lost. That trimaran was called the Buck's Fizz. And the night before the race, the owner and one other, they only had a crew of two, so they wanted to get two more people. And they bumped into a young couple in Cowes and became friendly with them. And they invited them along. They had some sailing experience, and they invited them along. And the tragedy was that all four were lost. And there were only the bodies of the skipper and his original crewmate were found by an American freighter passing by. But the young couple's bodies were never found. So it's just a chance meeting in Cowes, purely chance meeting, and they were lost the following day. Very tragic.
And have you ever seen any conditions like that since?
Well, funny, you heard Winky Nixon today talking about in the North Channel. It was a storm, Force 12. It was horrendous, even though it was inside in the Irish Sea. But because there was a south flowing tide against the southeast Force 12, it built up into enormous house-sized waves and very steep. So, I mean, we spent 27 hours tacking between the north of Ireland and Scotland and making no headway. And I very nearly went into Belfast to anchor. Times were different then back in 1975. Mightn't they be too welcome?
The Arnoli Baltimore lifeboat was one of several which spent up to 76 hours at sea. And regardless, a yacht owned by Ken Rohan was the first to be escorted in by it. Paul Rothschild, who had been on board the yacht, remembers it as if it was yesterday.
After we lost our rudder, everything went wild. It was amazing. The waves were colossal. The lifeboat would be four stories above you as they came down to get you. You had to throw sails out at the stern of the boat to stop you going down the waves too fast. My daughter was watching Nationwide that my wife recorded yesterday with her son-in-law back from New York, and they couldn't believe it. They didn't even know about it. Never seen waves so high. When you went down to the troughs, it was dead silent. And when you came up in the crest, it was blowing hell. And everything rattling around the boat, no steerage, trying to run the west way you can. And it was really, I don't have any regrets. I thought it was exciting, and it was one of the most exciting times of my life.
My name is Donald McClement. At the time of the 79 Fastnet, I was serving in the Royal Air Force, flying in search and rescue helicopters. But I was the skipper of the RAF Sailing Association yacht Black Arrow. And we finished and won Class 4, which, from my point of view, was probably the pinnacle of achievements I've had in sailing. But it was just an amazing day today to see people. I'm the sole British representative, although I'm from Cork, here, and what a pleasure to see all these people and see people that you sailed against 40, 50, 60 years ago. It was a tough race. I was lucky. We had a military crew. They were all Air Force. I was the captain, and military discipline was, everybody was used to it, so we didn't have any panics on board. We didn't have any questions. People got on with what they had to do, and yeah, we struggled through it. And of course, after all the gales, you think you're last, but we didn't have a transmitter on board, a radio transmitter, because at that time, a VHF radio was £1,000, and we wanted a new sail, and the new sail was £1,000, so we spent £1,000 on the sail. So all we had was a receiver, so we were listening to Radio 4, and I was listening to RTE radio, as it was then, I suppose, Radio Éireann. But we had no real inkling of the devastation that had happened.
Michael O'Leary. I was skippering Golden Lee in the 1979 Bad Fastnet. We got up to the rock. It was blowing so hard we made a decision not to go around. And we went along the south coast of Ireland till we picked up the light of Roach's Point. And we turned left into Crosshaven. All well on board. Boat held together, very well maintained by its owner, Leslie Curtez, a Hungarian man who lived in Dunleary. And we were put alongside the marina in Crosshaven and had a wonderful few days there before taking the boat back to Dunleary. And it's so wonderful to see all these people that we raced against 40 years ago. And we're still sailing today, and life goes on.
Thanks to Lorna Siggins. One of the lifeboats you heard mentioned there was Baltimore Lifeboat. It's one of the busiest and one of the most iconic in the country. And tomorrow night, a book will be launched to celebrate its centenary. Baltimore Lifeboat, a Community Story, 1919 to 2019, is by Eamon Langford. He came into studio and told me about the lifeboat.
Baltimore, at the time, was a very fishing area. And there's a tradition of boat building and seafaring and navigation and so on. And they had a fishery school which gave young men training and all those skills. So it was a long tradition of seafaring and fishing craft. And however, there was huge dangers involved with life at the sea, and there was great concern on the part of people in Baltimore about the safety of their fishermen and the dangers at sea to the mariner, to the traveller at sea. And a group of public-spirited people in Baltimore came together and decided to establish their lifeboat.
The people who first sail on the first lifeboat, some of their families are still involved the whole way through. It's very much a community effort.
Oh, that's right, yeah. Well, the original people who came together, I suppose one would call them kind of Anglo-Irish, but I mean, they were maritime people, and the local clergy, both Catholic and Church of Ireland, were involved, and of course they had the local bank manager, and people who were fairly well educated. But then they had people who went on the boats, and the skilled sailors of the island and the Baltimore, and it just happened that one family, young people saw what was happening, their parents, fathers going out, and they got involved themselves. And it's true, yes, there are particular families, the Bushes, the Cotters, the Cottrells. They've all been associated with the lifeboat, and others, of course, have all been steeped in that tradition of life-saving and boat building. And that's the case down to the present, although the boat building has all but ceased, apart from wooden boat development down in the Baltimore, in Old Court, near Baltimore.
And if we talk then, they've had some remarkable outings, some remarkable rescues over the years, and you recount a couple of them in your book. There's one, the Hazelside. Tell me about that.
In 1939, the SS Hazelside was on a journey from Canada with a cargo of wheat and timber, and approached the coast of Cork, some 11 miles off the coast, and they got a warning from a U-boat to abandon ship. The captain tried his best in a zigzag movement for a period of almost an hour.
So this was an early day in the war, and the captain of the U-boat decided he was going to give them warning before he sank them. Things changed, of course.
That's right, yeah. Anyhow, he made a gallant effort to escape, but he had to give up. U-boat was shelling the Hazelside, and it got into huge difficulty. It began to sink, and eventually they put two RAF planes came overhead. And once the U-boat had suffered and was shelling the Hazelside, and the RAF planes came, and the U-boat vanished, but they fired their torpedo in, and it sank the boat.
And this was witnessed from the shore.
That's right, yes. A man by the name of Dowman with his binoculars, saw the action from the beacon at Baltimore, and it was quite a clear morning. And people in Cape Clear got the SOS, and they headed out. Regan had a boat called the St. Ulton. It was a coaster, and it headed out. I think it was 10 people were on that boat, and they succeeded in rescuing, I think it was 20, 21 people from the boat. 11 were killed. There was a few Irish men as well, and there's also two brothers, McGannons, from the north of Ireland, and one of them came to visit Cape Clear Museum and an exhibition on the Hazelside in 1990. He was the last survivor of the Hazelside crew, and he came back to say thank you to the Baltimore people and the Cape Clear Islanders who had saved them in 24th of September 1939. Yeah.
Just a few days into the war. But another person then whose name we will all know, who was rescued by Baltimore lifeboat, Charles Haughey.
Oh, yeah, that's a famous story that flashed around the world. In September 1985, Charles Haughey was back in Dunqueen and Kerry launching a book, and his son and the four-man crew had... Charles had gone out to Dingle to launch the book, and his son brought their boat, family boat, the Torima two out to Dunhuin and picked up his father, and they headed for Cork, right? And they were heading, going to go to Kinsale and then on to Dublin. So on their way, the mist came down and they could hardly see 50 yards ahead of them, and they went on the rocks just below the mizzen lighthouse.
And they knew straight away they were sinking.
Oh, they did. Oh, yeah, they did. Yeah. But Conor Haughey managed to get an SOS off, and it was picked up by the lighthouse at the mizzen, and the Baltimore lifeboat were taxed to go to sea by the Valencia Marine Service.
And Charles Haughey himself recounted a couple of times his version of the rescue.
Yeah, he did. It was well recorded, like that. The radio broke down immediately after the SOS was sent, and they had to pile into the life raft, while Conor Haughey had a punt, and that's the way they walked away for about an hour or two, and the lifeboat or the lifehouse people kept a light shone on them, and that kept them encouraging them that the boat was coming. And so it did. The flares exploded and it lit up the whole place. And Charles Haughey, like, it was one of the greatest sights of his life, that this wonderful bright light and this shining boat, and with the crew of the Baltimore lifeboat coming to save the day. But when the crew were pulled on board to Charles Henry, the crew didn't recognise Haughey at all, but then one of the crew recognised him, and apparently he said, this is a capture, not a rescue. And of course they landed at Baltimore, and the media gave it huge coverage.
There's a famous photograph of a very relieved looking Charles Haughey and his family and crew in Bush's Bar, where they were brought more or less straight away.
That's right, yeah. Oh, that's right, yeah. And there was a great celebration there. A number of years later, on behalf of Cape Lea Museum, I approached the Haughey family, and they just suggested that perhaps I had heard that a diver had recovered the wheel of the boat of the Tauroma, and kind of gave a little nudge, and they were delighted to give the wheel of it, and it is restored and is on display in the Cape Lear Island Museum at present.
Another ship then that the name people will remember is the Kowloon Bridge. The Baltimore lifeboat was called out to that, but the weather was so bad the crew had to be removed by helicopter.
That's right, yeah. That was a disgraceful mismanagement and a messy job. It was carrying 160,000 tonnes of ore, right? The deck was splitting. While it was in Baltimore, actually.
In Bantry,
I beg pardon. There was a possibility that it could crash into another large ship that was discharging oil, right? And so it headed out to sea. It turned towards Baltimore, and it was decided to take the crew off.
Because the engine failed.
The engine failed, yeah. And the crew were taken off by a lifeboat, but when the captain of the Kowloon Bridge was getting on board the helicopter, he informed the pilot that he had left the engines running, and the Kowloon Bridge was heading for Baltimore Harbour, which would have been a terrible disaster. The villagers were very upset and the danger involved, but however it turned and went towards the Stag, where it sank.
That's a few miles up the coast. It went down and caused huge pollution all along that coast.
Yeah, that's right. And apparently the ship was bought for £1 by Mr. Kent. Nothing was done ever since. It couldn't be bought. Nobody could do anything with the thing. And the question remains, should the Kowloon Bridge have ever been allowed to leave Quebec?
The lifeboat, it also provides a lifeline to the islands in that part of the country.
That's right. I suppose one could say that the lifeboat is the ambulance, really, for the islander. You know, Cape Lear, Hare Island, Long Island and Shirkin are all dependent. Like, if anything goes wrong and if the boats can't sail and an emergency occurs, well, then they have to call the lifeboat. They've had huge success in rescuing people in the waters around the Islanders, and loads of events dealing with rescues on the islands. Somebody gets a heart attack, the boat can get there. They now have very modern and fast boats, and they can get to the island, to the eastern part of Cape Lear, for example, in about 10 minutes in the reef, the inshore boat.
And that book by Aim Langford, Baltimore Lifeboat, A Community Story, celebrating the centenary, is available for sale for €16 locally in Cork, or you can order it at baltimorelifeboatbook@gmail.com. And if you'd like to join me tomorrow night for the launch of that book, it's on in the Baltimore Sailing Club at 8 o'clock after the Munster game. And that's it for Seascapes for this week. We're back at the same time next Friday. Everything on the programme is podcast. It's on our website, rte.ie/seascapes. If you want to contact me or the programme, the email is seascapes@rte.ie. We're here next Friday. If you're in the water in the meantime, be safe.